Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Welcome to the Drabblecast, episode 486. The Drabblecast is an audio fiction magazine that brings strange stories by strange authors to strange listeners, such as yourself. I'm your host, Norm Sherman. Y'all like horses? Well, I don't know if you'll... Well, trigger warning, I guess, for this week's episode, then. Although they're not really horses, per se. They're... Oh, I don't want to spoil the lore. We bring you Those Who Forget, Those Who Perish, by K.W. Collard. K.W. Collard grew up weird in a one-caution-like town in the Appalachian foothills. They now live in an old textile city with their husband and a clowder of cats. Their fictions also appeared on Clark's World and Diabolical Plots, and they're on Twitter at Christian Writing. This story, Those Who Forget and Those Who Perish, was first published in Seize the Press in 2022. So without further ado, we bring you Those Who Forget and Those Who Perish by K.W. Collard. The morning after the ritual, the horse girls wake to the sting of the straw that prods the fresh seams of their new bodies. They wince and twist to get away from the crude stalks stabbing at their tender guts, but this only brings new and more unpleasant sensations. The stitches that join their flesh together with the flesh of another, a confidant, a friend, tug against their tender skin and hold it in place. Hold them in place. However much the horse girls might struggle, roughage will find its way inside them soon enough. Appetite changes topped the list of side effects they could expect. None of them had to ask what that meant. They signed anyway, piercing the pads of their ungloved thumbs with long, silver needles to press bloody prints onto parchment and seal their own fates. This ritual is one of fate, not choice. Morning light filters into the domed chamber through a dozen diamond-shaped windows that look out into the blue skies. Motes of dust sparkle in the crisscrossed rays. Snorts and moans bounce off the gold wainscoting on the cream-colored walls, and 11 of the figures on the floor begin to stir. They grunt and gyre in the straw. None dares to touch her stitched-up places. Some do worse. The red-headed bay, whose hair curls like flames, heaves with big, pitiful sobs. She has never been able to handle pain, not even so much as a scraped knee. All she wants is to lie still, but her legs burn and twitch and jump as unscratchable itches wriggle somewhere deep inside the bulk of her new body. She starts at every involuntary wish of her tail. Each unbidden flick and whirl a reminder of just how unfamiliar her body has become. The blonde Dunn begins to wail. She stares at the body next to her. The Perlino lies dead in the straw, her long black hair snaking over her torso like a burial shroud. The stitching has come loose at the belly, seeping dark blood and light viscera into the bedding below. The Dunn's howls echo across the chamber. One by one, her sisters begin to cry with her. Some manage to sit upright, while others languish in the warm straw, still trying to find their bearings in these foreign bodies. Those who can, the sorrel with the short natural, the strawberry blonde Cremello, and the palomino with no hair at all, not even eyelashes on her upper body, walk over to the Dunn. Unsteady on their fragile, finger-like legs, they surround the Perlino's corpse, cry over the oozing mass of stitched-up flesh, mourn the loss of a sister they never had the chance to know. Necessity cuts short their dirge. The body must be removed, the straw changed, the chamber cleansed. Their nurses escort them out to the paddock so they do not have to watch the tough, iron-armed men come to drag the black-haired woman's disjointed corpse from the room. They do not see the one whose heretic religion fills him with contempt for them, who handles her body without courtesy or care, who yanks at her torso for purchase until the stitches rip open between his stumpy fingers. They are not there when her intestines spill onto the floor, disappear under a boot, tear against the hard stone, fill the chamber with the smell of shit and death. Out in the paddock, the sun is bright and warm on their skin, the breeze cool in their hair, so much more hair than before, and they forget their sorrows over the fallen horse girl and revel in each other's company. They must become one with their new bodies, or perish in the end. Dapplings and Ronings crawl up the smooth flesh, transforming it. The piebald bronze arms have already begun to lighten around their shoulders. Beside her, darkening patches rise up from the black paint's hips to twist around her chubby, sallow stomach. Short, thick hairs protrude splinter-like from necks, shoulders, and backs, the beginnings of the manes they will braid in coded messages that mark their positions in the First King's court. Transformation is the price, and salvation the reward. Everything else lies in between. There are always 12 in the beginning. There are never 12 by the end. The Grey and the Roan die of infections. Later, when the Appaloosa breaks her leg trying to leap over the paddock gate, the nurses will come with knives to end her misery forever. Those who remain cry, not out of grief, but because they could be next. At night, they sing songs praising Ixion, the First King, who died so that horsekind could rule Erland. Some remember the prayers they learned in their father's houses, hymns and mantras to Ixion and his queen, Nephele, of the Cloud Nymphs. Their songs heap praise upon Nephele's daughter, Hylonome, their foremother, who won the First King's throne for him. The scriptures say she sprang forth with her sisters, fully armed and fully formed, from the place where their mother's tears struck the battlefield on which Ixion died. They look at the statues carved in her honor and marvel at her excellence, the perfect union of strength and beauty, grace and ferocity, horsekind and humanity. The horse girls marry Hylonome's nephews, those brawny stallion princes who looked like the First King and governed his nation. So it has always been. When the stallions come to call, the nurses drape layers upon layers of fine black lace over the horse girls' heads, shrouding them from view. Nervous hooves are all the brides-to-be can see of their princes, and none of them will come away impressed. How can they, when none of the stallions has inherited the First King's golden hooves? But the wedding will go on as planned, one wedding for one sisterhood. After the ceremony, the new couples race through Erland to the fine houses that await them in the countryside. Some of the horse girls beat their pampered princes, and most of those who do suffer for it. Of the 8 who survive the chamber, only 2, the Sorrel and the Bay, will find that they love their husbands in a year's time. Of the other 6, 1, the sooty black whose pale blonde fringes never darkened enough to match her lower body, takes up arms against her husband. Her tower window shatters just before her heavy body crashes against the pavement below. Inside, her husband lies dead on the stone floor, body flayed by her barbed whips, head smoking in the fireplace as the embers burn away his fine black hair. Only when the servants drag her corpse to the pit of her unmarked grave do they discover the prince's ears torn off in her bloody mouth. 2 more, the Dun and the Cremello, eat the bright pink oleander that grows along the river valleys. The Dun wades into the river, lets it ferry her body far away. Her mane of red curls streams down the river behind her like a war banner as she fights to stay afloat. But the current is too quick, too strong, and she takes her final labored breaths with her knees dragging along the riverbed. The Cremello decides to die as she lived, under Erland's bright sun. As she kicks and fights for breath in the rocky valley, the taste of the oleander on her tongue is less bitter than the years of her life spent on hooves. The rest live happily, unhappily, or somewhere in the middle, to bear their prince's foals. Their unions produce only sons, stallions fated to marry horse girls of their mother's choosing when they come of age. The horse girls will select their sons' future wives from the houses of Erland's human lords, descendants of those who swore fealty to the undying throne centuries before. Years pass in this way. To become a horse girl is to forget, to forfeit humanity for something greater than yourself. The next time the horse girls set hoof in that cream and gold chamber with the diamond-shaped windows, they no longer remember what it was like to race over the hill and under the dale on the backs of their headstrong steeds. The horse girls cannot recall the bonding prayers they once chanted each night as they brushed down their mounts, nor what it was like to whisper their secrets into those long, open ears. But those prayers lie fresh on the tongues of the human lord's daughters, each one intimately familiar with the tickle of a filly's ear against her lips and cheeks. Erland's finest young women grow up knowing that one day they will be joined together with the horses they love. But none can comprehend the gravity of such a thing until it comes to pass. The next morning, the 12 chosen daughters awaken to their new fate as horse girls. Within a year, they do not remember their old lives at all. With thick, full manes and muscles wrapped in cords of sinew, they prepare to marry the greatest princes in all Erland. On her wedding night, as a stallion prince mounts her for the first time, no horse girl can remember how it felt to stand on her old legs. She has forgotten the place in between where her human husband might have entered her, had she not been chosen, fated, destined to transcend. Nor can she recall the pleasure derived from touching that place on cool summer nights when the smell of the rolling meadows came strong through the window. For her, there is only the duty and pride of being one of Ixion's daughters, her honor and a faded scar, which she will never remember getting. And so it has been. And so it will be. And that was our story. Hope you enjoyed it. I'll never look at horse girls the same way again. That's our show this week, folks. Remember, the Drabblecast is brought to you with a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License, which means don't change it, don't sell it, but feel free to share it all you like. Tell a friend, write us a review on iTunes, spread the weird. Special thanks to our episode artist this week, Steve Lilly. Find Steve on Twitter at SteveArtyPerson. The Drabblecast is brought to you by Nicole Neely, Beau Kyer, Audrey Kay, Jossie Gerwig, Sean Gentry, Melissa Knight, Wyan Scott, A Shiny Baby Tooth and an Oyster, Joe Pietras, Oren Pratt, R. Epstein, Anna Rose, Mario Lovett, and yours truly, Norm Sherman. Reminding you, you gotta become one with your new bodies or perish, folks. In the end.
A long time ago, we used to be friends, but I haven't thought of you lately.
Greetings, adventurers. Today we're excited to introduce you to a new story, Dark Dice, a horror podcast that blurs the line between actual play and audio drama, where the story is determined by the roll of the dice. Six adventurers embark on a journey into the ruinous domain of the Nameless God. They will never be the same again. One of the players is not what they seem after a doppelganger, a creature that can assume the form and voice of whatever it kills, infiltrates the team. As the players are picked off and replaced one at a time, can they figure out who the monster is before it's too late? Can you? Here's a quick example of what our show sounds like.
The shambler with the jar of liquid inside of him.
Soren Arkwright let loose an arrow that cracked the glass, passing through the spine of the creature. The shambler still managed to maintain its forward momentum, but stumbled as it eagerly tried to bite and swipe at Soren, landing near his feet.
As Jeff Goldblum has now joined our cast, Dark Dice is available however you listen to podcasts.